Conversation. It's episode 180. Our guest is Holly Ecker. She is a freelance museum educator working in New York City. She covers pretty much all the Fifth Avenue museums, the Guggenheim, the Met, the Studio Museum in Harlem around the corner, and so on. And if you think she knows guest from 168, Lauren Kaplan, indeed they do. They're friends, and that's how we connected. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. Here are the images that you can go check out as you listen to this episode. There are, Lauren is part of a group called Arts and Minds. That's one of the programs she's with. And there are various Arts and Minds images, not only teaching, but kind of performing in front of her students. These include seniors with dementia, seniors with Alzheimer's, seniors without dementia or Alzheimer's. And she also works with public and private school kids. And so there's a shot of one of her private school kids. There's a boys' school where they wear a suit and tie to school every day. So there's one of those. And Rembrandt's Aristotle with a bust of Homer, which is crucial to one of her anecdotes. So go check all those out on the website. And we talk about gentrification. She does live in Harlem, as well as having taught at the Studio Museum. So good to cover Harlem for a change, as opposed to Brooklyn. Before we get into the conversation, just wanted to take a quick moment and remind you this is a listener-supported show. And I want us to keep this to a once-a-week show. And the way that we're going to do that is with your assistance, if you would be so kind. I want to thank a couple of recent patrons who have joined Patreon in the last week. Thank you to both of you. You know who you are. Hopefully you can join that fray. You can support the show for as little as a dollar a month. If you start at $3, you will be eligible for some of the lovely rewards. So hopefully you can start there. But that's one way you can support the show. The other, of course, is you can just donate in a one-off fashion via PayPal. And those are both linked through theconversationpod.com/support. And I'm telling you that now because I do want to keep the show at once a week as opposed to moving to once every other week. And I would be ashamed to move it down for everybody who's been supporting the show. So please join them if you haven't. And thank you very much in advance. Now let's get to that conversation with Holly. One more thing. We're in March 3rd as I record this. I could get political, but I'm going to give you a little reprieve from that. I will give you more information about an upcoming episode in which we do talk politics quite a bit. So that's coming up on the back end. In the meantime, thank you for being here. Talk to you in the back end. Where are you? Are you at home?
Oh, yeah. I'm in my house at my desk.
And what neighborhood is that?
Oh, I live in Harlem. I live in right near the Apollo Theater.
So wow.
I'm at 120. Yeah, that's 122nd Street.
See, I don't know if you know this, but one of my my first go-to topics, especially with New York guests, is where you are, and you know, and then that becomes a conversation about how the neighborhood is and how it's changed and changing and so on. And I think you're my uh-huh. I think you're my second Harlem guest. Actually, I was almost going to say first, I had an artist who has been there for a long time, but that was like 3 years ago, probably. So how long have you been in Harlem?
I moved to Harlem in 2009 when I was actually living in Italy before that, and I finished out some research I was doing there and then came back here to get my master's degree at Columbia University at Teachers College, and ended up finding this apartment right around the corner.
Wow.
And just stayed here.
Right.
Yeah, I just fell in love with the neighborhood. And once I started working, you know, my ceramic studio was in the basement of Teachers College. So that was within walking distance. And then Once I got employed by all the Fifth Avenue museums, it was such an easy location to get to work. And then I just really liked it here. I liked my neighbors and
Are you kind of on the, if you were to, if one were to orient themselves from Central Park North, are you more to the west or more to the east?
I'm more to the west, yeah.
Okay.
I'm,
so you're closer to Columbia.
I'm on Manhattan Avenue, which is kind of like 9th Avenue, I guess.
Right.
It's right near, Morningside Park and Amsterdam and
Got it.
7th. I guess I'm like 8th or 9th Avenue, yeah.
So you're almost as much Upper West Side as Harlem in a sense, it sounds like.
It's a little further east, but...
Close.
It's close, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it literally is a one-minute walk from the Apollo Theater where I live.
Oh, okay, got
like
it,
the
right.
The subway station I get off at 125th, you see the Apollo, and then you walk to my house.
Got
and
it.
You also see Chuck E. Cheese, yeah.
It's funny to picture, think of a Chuck E. Cheese in Manhattan at all, but in Harlem,
it's a big
in
one
Harlem
too,
no less.
It's like
yeah.
full of kids for birthdays
right.
and
right.
Parties, yeah.
So what is your familiarity with... Not necessarily the whole history of Harlem, because that's like a whole nother conversation, but just in terms of the gentrification arc, you know, because by the time you moved there, it had already probably changed quite a bit. And since you've moved there, I imagine it's changed. It's gone through another iteration, more or less.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I am a gentrifier for sure. I'm a Jewish white woman who's come to get good rent because I was going to Columbia. Like
right.
That.
Right. Yeah.
But that being said, my neighbors, historically, like three generations back, some of my neighbors have owned the brownstones, who are African-American, have owned the brownstones that they live in.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone on my street that has been there for that long, like, knows each other and talks mm-hmm. to each other and sits outside on the stoop. And, you know, I've definitely become part of my street culture neighborhood.
Right.
Which I did not experience living in other neighborhoods of Manhattan as much that were not historically African-American. And who knows, that could have been how I was at the time or
mm-hmm.
the neighborhoods or just a variety of people living in those neighborhoods. But I would say that when I first moved here, there was not even a supermarket within walking distance, like within a 5-minute walking distance.
Right.
And now that I've moved here, the street that used to be like a gas station and many, many delis is just like super high loft, you know, condos and fancy restaurants and lots of baby carriages. And, but it's not, it's gentrified, but I would say both racially and class wise, it's become more middle class. But you see a lot of mixed couples and gay and lesbian couples. And
You mentioned, I wanted to go back to, you know, you mentioned there some of your immediate neighbors, it sounds like, are African-American brownstone homeowners and whatnot. And I just wanted to ask you if you had had an opportunity to have a conversation with any of them about how they feel about... for lack of a better term, non-native gentrifiers.
No, that's not really my agenda. I mean, we just hang out as people together and friends.
Right.
I would say the conversation is more geared usually towards them sharing with me the very extensive history of our street and this one and this one and this mother and this grandmother and, you know, this one used to take people in.
Right.
It's more about that. It's more about history and sharing. I mean, I know so, like one woman, for example, who lives next to me, her son is a very well-known rap artist from Harlem. And she, this woman, Arlene, was just an amazing pioneer of our neighborhood. And when I first moved in, you know, she was our next door neighbor and she would help me shovel the street and tell me about when to put the garbage out. And she'd just tell me stories and stories about being a social worker when she was still working age and how many people she helped and just that her house was like a rotating safe place for all friends and family to come stay whenever they needed to. And then when she got a little bit older, she had was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And right around that time, I had begun, I wanted to work at a place, like in my neighborhood, local place. And so I started to work at the Studio Museum in Harlem, which is on it's 125th Street, I think, between Adam Clayton Powell and Lenox. So it's a couple blocks, it's about a 10-minute walk from my house. And she ended up coming to that program with her, one of her sons, and also this son who's this musician. And it just felt great to be able to, you know, we did the drawing activity of portraits across the table. So it, I don't know why I got on this whole track of it, but it just felt really great to be able to give back something for her. She gave me so much. She made me feel so welcome. And I even attended her funeral. It was like 2 summers ago in a local church, a local, and I had never attended like a Harlem funeral from someone such a pioneer of the community. So I know you're asking me about like gentrification and the, you know, but when you're living here, I'm sure it comes up, but it's more like I'm a guest in everyone else's life here. And it just didn't fit, never really felt appropriate for me to talk, you know, to make it like a thing about, of course, race comes up all the time, but to make it like, tell me about gentrification over the years. No.
Right. Yeah. No, I, all of that is on topic actually, even though you, at one point you were just a second ago, you were wondering how you got onto this. I mean, this is all on topic. I was just kind of coming from a place of the way you described the situation. I guess maybe the question I asked wasn't quite the right one. Maybe it was more, you know, do you get a sense of people's feeling about how the neighborhood has changed? Maybe it would have been a better question. I think you already kind of answered that.
Yeah.
You know, just because, go ahead.
It has changed for sure. But I would say that, yes, there are more white people here and wealthier people here, but it's still dominated. Like, this is a safe neighborhood for African Americans. This is their neighborhood.
Right.
And, like, yes, I live here, but I'm also a guest here. I feel, and I've been welcomed. I mean, like I just mentioned, it's really very community based on my street. Everyone says hi and how are you doing? And but yeah, there's
that's
definitely
great.
A present.
I don't think you can say that about too many Brooklyn neighborhoods.
But it's just like my one street. You know, it's not. I don't know how that extends. You go up to 135th, I just can literally speak about from 122nd to 123rd Street on Manhattan Avenue where I live.
Right.
And that space feels really safe to me. I mean, I can remember I had been dating someone and it ended and I had only known this space like with a boyfriend. And then suddenly I was a single woman on my own, single white woman on my own in Harlem. And oh my God, is it going to be okay? And like all these preconceived notions I had that were again and again proved false, like they were my own biases.
Right.
But my neighbors would come meet, they'd be like, text me when you get to the train station, we'll come walk you home. I mean, just like lovely people. So anyway, I guess it will all come and make sense. But that is the neighborhood I live in. And
well,
I
just
have no intention of
Yeah. Well, let me just ask you one more question about Harlem, because I can picture that your lifestyle would have you, and from based on the walk that you just described, that you're going maybe more, you're going more laterally and then southward, as it were, in Manhattan, as opposed to, I just wonder for a second what it, and you kind of suggested that it's not something you're that familiar with, but if you were to go north, you know, towards the tip of the northern tip, you know, if you would imagine from whatever experience you have, if it's also had similar gentrification or not as much.
It does. Yeah. Friends of mine, good friends of mine live on 136th and a little bit further east. They're closer to 7th Avenue.
Right.
Their place is fine. I walk home at 2 a.m. from there. No problem.
Okay. Okay. Got it.
I used to dance. I also am a salsa dancer.
Right.
Not by birth, obviously, but it's been about 5 years that I've pretty consistently gone dancing into a school. The school I started on was originally located on 124th Street and 2nd Avenue. So that walk is about 20 to 30 minutes from my house or the bus, and I'd be rehearsing or practicing like pretty late, like 10:30 at night. And there you would see definitely a less gentrified neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more people on drugs just wandering the streets, and
mm-hmm.
more warehouses and more less people. And the people you did see out at that late hour, you probably didn't want to be hanging out around there too long.
Do they still call that Spanish Harlem, the East Side?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Spanish Harlem, East Harlem. So, you
Got
know,
it.
But that was my routine for 2 years. I, you know, never stopped me from going home. I never had any, you know, dangerous experiences, but not, I wouldn't move there, let's put it that way.
Sure.
When the studio moved, like, I was not sad to go to another location.
Got it.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, well, of course. Very, very well. You did mention in passing the Alzheimer's teaching, and so there's let's just go through the list of categories of alternative teaching that you do. You've worked with Alzheimer's. You've worked with deaf people. What other categories are there?
The primary audiences that I find myself working with nowadays, and it's been, you know, a good 8 or 9 years that I'm in this profession, so I've really narrowed it down to what I like the best.
Okay.
Half of my week, I would say I spend with senior citizens who either have dementia or some form of dementia,
mm-hmm.
and just typical senior citizens. So
mm-hmm.
I work with senior programs that are usually off-site.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go to something called a NORC, which I didn't know what that was at first, and it stands for a naturally occurring retirement community.
Wow.
And so they've all either were born in the same housing building, apartments, or they married. I mean, some of the people I work with went to junior high together.
Mm.
I mean, we were doing an art class, and I sometimes play DJ Holly while we're making art, and I take requests from my students, and yeah, it's really nerdy, but they love it. So one of them had requested Teenager in Love. You know, it's like, why must I be a teenager in love?
Right.
And then Margot had requested that, and then another guy said, oh, I remember this song. You kissed Jimmy B at the dance to this song on our junior high dance. They're in their 70s and 80s, some of them. So, but they all know each other their whole life. So that is some of the populations I work with. I do a weekly Friday class with them where, and I did kind of think about wanting to tell you more about this because some of them cannot hear me at all. And I have to, you know, I sit right next to one. I should really get a FM device to amplify my voice. But they went to art school as kids, you know, and one of them had a stroke and she can't use her hand, but she was a famous sculptor, but she can only use one of her hands now.
Mm.
And another one, I mean, they're just lovely people. They all have this really extensive art history and art education, but they don't have opportunities to use it. And this is the only time they tell me over and over again during the week that they feel alive and young and they love the conversations. We usually do about a 40-minute inquiry-based discussion where I'll show 2 to 3 artworks. This is through the Whitney Museum of American Art.
Mm.
And we'll just have an open-ended. I mean, last week we looked at Alison Farr. The week before we focused on pop art and Andy Warhol. And just they go on and on. And I said, you want to look at another one or should we start making? No, another one. And then after that, we make, you know, we work with clay or painting. I did printmaking. I did mono printing with them about 2 weeks ago. And one of the men afterwards came up to me and just said, you know, Holly, like, I haven't felt this much like a kid since I was a kid. Thank you so much. You know, so anyway, I love them. Obviously, I'm going on and on about them. But that's just one population. And then I would say 2 or 3 days during the week, I work with people that are at various stages of Alzheimer's or dementia,
mm-hmm.
and their caregivers.
Okay.
So one of those happens at the Met,
mm-hmm.
and that's gallery-based. And I've done 3 different cycles of 5 to 6 sessions each.
Mm-hmm.
And this group, it's Columbia University, got some grant money to... let's say they just got diagnosed, like they just found out they have early onset Alzheimer's, so they might be in their 50s,
mm-hmm.
Or they're a little bit older and they just got diagnosed with some form of dementia. And then their family members, usually family members, a few people with professional caregivers they come to me as like an introduction to how art-based programs may support their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they work with me, we filter them. The idea is that they will be filtered into the already existing programs for people with dementia and their caregivers in New York City. So that has been amazing, and I'll talk more about that. Yeah, I can do that now. I can.
Well, let me jump in for a minute. Before you get more into the categories or the types of students that you work with, did you get into teaching these different bodies? Is it a question of demand? Like, that's where the most demand in sort of the museum educating mm-hmm. world that you're in? Or is it more, mm-hmm. what was the reason ultimately?
I thought about that a lot. Like, why is it such a focus of my work nowadays?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, it's full circle for me, because my early training was working with the deaf community and learning a separate language, sometimes very high functioning deaf children and deaf adults. But a lot of times I worked with deaf people from immigrating from other countries who did not have extensive access to education.
Mm-hmm.
So they were deaf, but they were also, you know, not so able to read or process, just because of a result of like missing out on the critical period of learning from zero
right.
to six and then onwards.
That must have been extremely challenging. What was that like?
Oh my God, I could tell you stories about that too. That my first job was with the Lexington School for the Deaf in Jackson Heights, Queens. I was mm-hmm. 22 or 23.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a vocational services department, and mm-hmm. I was an intensive job coach. And a lot of my clients were more of the mid to low functioning level. Like, I guess they were deaf, but really their biggest issues was that they never went to school and the parents kept them, you know, whatever country they were from, they just didn't go to school.
Mm.
And I would help train them as a like communication facilitator / interpreter / social worker, get them into their job. I mean, I worked in hotels. They were maids in hotels. They were kitchen support service, prep chefs, sous chefs, you know, stockroom attendants at Banana Republic. And I trained them at their jobs and stayed with them for 3 months throughout
wow.
the first 3 months of their job. And this was my earliest professional, you know, it was like the most extreme form of education you can imagine. I mean, I can remember having to explain to somebody that they had to go to immigration or they were going to get sent home. How do you explain immigration to someone who doesn't speak, like they don't read at all?
Right.
How do you do that? I mean, I was so young. Anyway,
how did you do it?
Did it. I think I brought in an American flag. I think I brought in a concrete object, and
right.
I brought in, I can't remember what country they were from, but probably from Mexico, because a lot of my clients were from Mexico, and I brought their flag. I mean, it's going to sound so crazy, but to hold up the flag and say, me from this, you know, point of the flag, me, American, show the sign
right.
for American.
Right.
Me allowed, me stay, can't, like, I can stay here. I'm born here. You flag Mexico, you know, I'm using ASL grammar,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but using the concrete option, I guess that's what I did.
Here's the term that's coming to mind. High stakes charades, maybe.
I don't want to say charades
right.
because that makes it sound like the American Sign Language is not an official language.
Sure.
It's not a game. It's not a acting out. But it is, I guess, high stakes in the sense that you cannot use a normal word order and grammar.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's very, very visual-based, concrete-based information
mm-hmm.
to get a very non, like a more abstract concept across. And I don't know that I did it perfectly, but hard to know.
but even in some cases, it sounds like some of the people you were working with only had a minimal grasp of American Sign Language or of sign language.
Yes, that's
yeah.
correct. That's
right.
absolutely correct.
Right.
So, and in some cases, you know, those people were not fit to hold a job in the long term.
Mm.
You know, they also suffer from mental illness. Some of my clients had schizophrenia and emotional disturbance as
mm-hmm.
a result of family history or just, you know, not being allowed to be a social person in the world. They were just like locked in a room their whole life.
Right.
Before they moved to America.
Right.
Anyway, you asked, this is a very long-winded kind of way, how did I get into Alzheimer's?
Yeah.
I think because my language skills were so challenged at that time, and my communication skills, and like, how do you teach someone the fact, you know, for example, I remember one guy was a dishwasher, and he would, there would be like 20 forks and 20 knives and 10 plates, and he would take one fork, dry it off, walk it to the drawer, walk back, take another fork, dry it, you know, and I had to say, you know what? What would happen if you dried all 10 at the same time, took them in one pile, and then walked them all to the drawer? Think of how much time you'd save, you know?
Right.
And he got it. And it's like, he's like, oh my God, I'm so much faster. My boss said I'm doing great. And okay, so fast forward to Alzheimer's. Some of my clients are really, really far progressed with Alzheimer's. They can't talk. They have no more expressive abilities. They can hardly stand up and sit down. And so I found myself tapping into the same skills that I developed as a 22, 23-year-old. And suddenly it was working. It was, you know, it was like, oh, my God, this woman, Polly, she can hardly sit down. She can't grasp anything. She says, ma, 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 ma. She has no the vocal cords don't work. She was very stressed out. This was a few weeks ago, and we gave her some clay. We were looking at an object made of clay, then cast in bronze by Richard Hunt at the Studio Museum. And my colleague, Nellie, gave her some model magic. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's kind of a Crayola plastic-based gallery-safe clay. And started pushing it on her arms and pushing it into her hands. And her whole demeanor changed. She sat back in her chair and just went, Now, it's a very simplified thing, but she went home happy that day.
Right.
And because of something we did, it's because of her, you know, Nellie's son, two of her sons are on the autism spectrum. They have autism spectrum disorder. And so that both of us come to working with this population from a different population at first. But because of that, I think that the skills regenerate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I want to,
So that's how I got into it.
Yeah, yeah. But see, the big picture, that's kind of what I'm curious about as you're describing this. And we could go in a number of directions. But for the first one, I just want to sort of establish that you sort of early on got into, you know, people with certain disabilities, and that sort of became your specialty, as it were. You can correct me if I'm wrong at any point, but the larger point that I guess I'm getting to is, on one hand, I mean, if you're working in museums, maybe museums are a really popular destination for people with certain disabilities, you know, for various reasons, deaf people for visual reasons, Alzheimer's people for visceral reasons, and so on. So on one hand, I'm just wondering, you know, is there a big demand there? And on the other, maybe an even more important question, that's sort of the subtext running through maybe our conversation and your career, in a sense, is, do you think, looking back or looking even at the present, it's ultimately been perhaps more, and I'm sorry if I'm putting words in your mouth, but more challenging, but also more satisfying, maybe working with disabled people versus, you know, people of privilege that typically do museum tours and that kind of thing?
Okay, so I will address both questions. Let me make sure I got.
Let me address
the second one, because that's, I think, more interesting for me.
Sure.
Just to be clear, I don't specifically just work with people with disabilities or without dementia or deafness. I learned this really early on. I was a Fulbright scholar in Italy in their Italian deafness program. And my mentor, Dr. Elena Radetzky, she also grew up in New York and was hearing, also Jewish, and spent her life working with the deaf community. And she told me very early on, you have to always keep your teaching hand in both pots.
Meaning,
with your own people of your own background. And then if you're a hearing person working with deaf, you better stay working with hearing and also work with deaf, because it will keep the level that you are teaching high for the deaf people. Like, I see too often throughout the years, as she has as well, hearing people who do come from a privileged background in the sense that they're hearing and they're going to work with deaf who don't have the privilege of hearing in a hearing world, and they teach down to the deaf people. Oh, they can't do it. They can't read.
Right.
They're not smart enough. They don't know how to do that. But then I know what it's like, typical second grader. I know what a typical second grader can do. I work with them half the week. And then if I'm working with someone else, I can then, you know, maybe I'm tweaking a little bit the type of teaching I'm doing, but my expectation is just as high of what a seven-year-old can do, whether they hear or they're deaf. So for me, yes, it is much more rewarding for me. I actually think all teaching is rewarding. And I think, you know, maybe later I can get into a story. I worked with very privileged young boys from an all-boys school on the Upper East Side this past semester. And I kind of went into it feeling kind of like what you were suggesting, like maybe it's not going to be that effective. They already come from such privilege. What, they don't need me, you know, but they taught me so much. And at the end of the day, it was just as rewarding working with them, hearing their ideas, seeing them visually express the things they've went through in their lives. So yes, I'm interested. I'm not going to just work with hearing kids from rich Upper East Side school, but if I did have my choice, I probably would prefer to more work with the Alzheimer's, people with Alzheimer's and dementia, as well as the deaf.
Right.
So it's both. I guess it's both of what you're asking, but
So you're,
I hate seeing people work with the elderly and like patronizing them, like,
oh yeah,
sweetie baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something I don't do. And
sure,
I do push people hard. So, but part of the reason I feel I'm able to do that is maybe because I work with both seniors that do have dementia and those that are just typical seniors.
Yeah.
Something about that feels important to me. I'm not sure if I'm expressing it.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, you are. Yeah. No. And just to clarify, so you're working with, seniors, both with disabilities and without. You're working with deaf, and then is it almost half your working time that's with regular kids, or and do you work with
typical kids?
Yeah,
yeah. More half or a little more than half.
Okay,
3 to 4 mornings a week. I'm with typical New York City public and private school children from grades K through 12.
Okay.
And then most afternoons I work with adults. I would say half the week I'm with dementia, people with dementia and caregivers, and the other half I work with, you know, typical seniors.
Got it. Okay.
So it's pretty, you know, across the board.
And as far as with the school kids, are you work, because it sounded like it with the private school Upper East Side kids, are you working with them like once a week for a semester kind of thing, or what's sort of the time frame?
So now I'm about to start an 8-week after school course at the Guggenheim for any kid who wants to come, who can afford the entry fee. But most mornings is a one-off program. They will either come to the Whitney Museum, where I'll take them through the galleries, or they'll be at the Guggenheim Museum. Yeah, those are the places where I teach kids in the mornings. I also do an after-school program at a public middle school through the Jewish Museum, and that's all year on a Thursday. So depending on the time, I do a range of partnerships. Some of them are 4 weeks. Some of them are 10 weeks. Some of them are 8 weeks. So it really depends on the month.
Right. So like with the Jewish Museum students, then you're really getting pretty familiar with a lot of them as opposed to these one-off type situations.
And like, oh my God, I'll tell you stories about
Please.
Them too. Just like,
let the fun begin. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this particular school I'm working at, I'm amazed. And a friend of mine has been teaching there with me. I'm just amazed at how normal it is for kids to be comfortable and out with their sexuality.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like we have, I mean, we joke about it, but we have like the queer kids table, girls who read table. They're like, video game boys table.
Wow.
But they're like distinct tables that they self-congregate at.
Right.
And, you know, there's six of them at that table, and they all talk about that they're gay or lesbian. And one of them has even asked me to change his pronoun from she to he.
Wow. And how old are these kids?
And so we did their seventh and eighth grade.
Okay. So 12, 13. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been, I mean, I can remember being in high school and being part of like LGBTQ group and asking my principal with a friend of mine to start like a gay straight alliance. And he told me, no, that's not the kind of message this school is going to send.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's the 90s, but.
And when I was in high school, there was no LGBTQ. So
yeah,
there you go.
No one would even say they were probably so.
Right. Not many. Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
so
we did
it's crazy.
A character
yeah.
thing with these kids, right? We did a, they asked me for cartooning. They want to learn how to do cartooning. I don't really know about cartooning, but my friend Diego Lopez, he's like a professional illustrator and storyboard artist, and he knows a lot about cartooning. So we hired him, and he came in and taught them and asked them to do like a shape dominant character. So circles are more friendly and triangles are more evil and mean and squares are more stoic, right? He taught them this language about shapes.
Mm.
And this one student, she made egg boy.
Mm-hmm.
She said an egg boy was all round and everything was circles. And she said, can it be egg boy, B-O-I? I'm like, okay, no problem.
Right.
But
right.
This was not on my mind as a seventh and eighth grader. It's been amazing to see.
Yeah.
This is totally sidebar, but they fascinate me, and I do know them all quite well. And
mm-hmm.
It's just great. Anyway, that's my Thursday afternoon.
Wow. Yeah, I guess.
And then.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I guess the thought that comes to mind as you describe that environment is, speaking of privileged, I mean, I know that that's maybe a controversial word to use, but I mean, how lucky or great, maybe, is, if you prefer, if lucky is not the right word, that these kids have that clarity and that acceptance, you know, when you don't have to go, not only do you not have to go very far, you just, you know, in our own time, if you go to the certain places, you'll find something very different.
Yes, I totally agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're amazing artists, and they love talking about art. And
mm-hmm.
You know, Diego, also my friend who co-taught with me, he also teaches at another space called HMI, which I don't remember exactly what it stands for, but I know that it's for a little bit older kids who are LGBTQ, you know, safe space, at more like a shelter situation where they can take a shower and eat something and speak to a psychiatrist or psychologist if they want to, and also make art.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where most of his experiences are, and that's downtown. And he says he can't, it's very challenging to get kids to, like, do the lesson he's prepared. And then he comes uptown to this very nice public, I mean, it's public school, but it's a very nice neighborhood. And most of the kids that come to my after school are self-selecting.
Mm-hmm.
And they mostly are part of this Delta program, which is like a gifted and talented program within the school.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said that he was like, could not believe how motivated all these kids were to make art, and they show up every week, and they have each other, and they have us, and it's just a very strong contrast.
Yeah. Hmm.
Anyway, so that's a long, very long-winded way, but to answer your other question about is
yes.
there a need for it, definitely there's a need for it. And
right.
There's a huge need for people with dementia. Like at the Met, we have six groups every single time we do Met Escapes, which is our program, like bi-monthly for people with dementia and their caregivers, six groups of 10 people per group.
Right.
And there's a waiting list. There's a huge need.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. And I don't know, for lack of a better question, the people, the seniors with dementia, is there any sort of higher, what am I trying to say? Is there any kind of sneaky sense that they have with art, you know, so that their dementia is crumbling their brains in a certain way. But is there, at the same time, is there, you know, is their right brain flourishing in a certain way?
So I had a similar question. You know, you were asking me, like, how did I even get into this work with
right.
people with dementia?
Right.
I didn't. My friend got pregnant, and she said, can you sub for me? It's at the Studio Museum. It's next to your house. Can you do it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. And I just did it. And then 6 years later, I fell in love with it. But,
right.
Right. I would say, you know, we've had extensive training from a man named Dr. Jamie Noble, who's on the board of directors for this Arts and Minds organization.
Right. Which is you're very much a part of.
Yes, I'm a very much part.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite places to work.
Mm-hmm.
He did a training for all of us about this very question, you know, because a lot of times husbands and wives who just got diagnosed, their partners say, well, is this going to help them remember better?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's not that it helps them remember better. It's just that it improves something called cognitive reserve.
Mm.
And cognitive reserve, if you want to look it up, it's really interesting. But mm-hmm. the way Dr. Noble described it to us, it's anything like language-based, a second language, or music, or art, or literature, or reading, anything that keeps your mind active helps prolong the decline once you get, you know, once things start going really bad.
Right.
There's no turning back, in a sense.
Right.
And that, I guess that's what you would call late-stage dementia. But when you're recently diagnosed and you have a high cognitive reserve, you're going to be able to push off this decline longer than someone who doesn't.
Right.
So in a certain sense, our programs help prolong their cognitive reserve,
mm-hmm.
but it also increases kind of serotonin happiness levels.
Right.
And takes them out of the monotony of every single day sitting in their house with the husband or wife or caregiver just watching them or watching TV.
Right.
It keeps them active. Now, have there been amazing moments where we'll be sitting in front of an artwork and they say some profound, incredibly clear and cohesive interpretive thing? Yes, all
yeah.
the time.
What is one example comes to mind for you?
So for me, for example, let's see. I was with this recently diagnosed group. I think I may have mentioned this to you another time we spoke, but mm-hmm. we looked at the Rembrandt painting Aristotle with the Bust of Homer at the Met. Everyone look it up immediately while you're listening
right,
to this because
right.
it's an amazing painting.
We'll post it. Yeah.
And the whole point, the whole message of this painting, this one man who the whole tour told me he couldn't see, painting is too dark, this whole thing is a bust, he can't see, it's too much walking, this is not why he didn't want to come here, and the daughters are like rolling their eyes at me.
Mm-hmm.
He looks at the painting, I say, you know, is there anything you want to share? What do you see? That's my usual lead-in.
Right.
It's just about the concrete, just about, not like, what does this make you remember? I never say something like that. And he said, this painting, it's basically, he's holding the head of Homer, and he's saying, who am I, and who's going to remember me, and will I remember anything?
Mm-hmm.
And his daughters just look at me like, oh, my God, like their eyes are popping out of their head. He basically summarized the whole painting. That's the message of the painting.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Aristotle, like, will people remember me in 500 years like they remember Homer? And then, but he added on this part about, and will I remember anything?
Right.
And then it was just this beautiful moment of him speaking about his disease, you know, speaking about how he feels, and suddenly this artwork has a new meaning. It's relevant for him.
He's mm-hmm.
made it alive for us, and his daughters suddenly see him expressing something about what's going on inside him. That happens all the time. Something like that, that's every single time I teach.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah.
So and then also, mm-hmm. a lot of the... Sorry, go ahead, Michael.
I was going to say, and then if you are getting these revelations from your students, you're maybe presumably seeing works in a different way occasionally yourself.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
I mean, that's
why
I'm addicted to it. It's
right.
Like super selfish motive.
Wow.
Like, cool. I never thought of it that way. Yeah.
That's, it's really hard to wrap one's head around, a teacher being addicted to teaching. That's a new meme, I think.
Well, Let's design it.
Yeah, let's design it.
I am addicted to it.
That's great.
I.
That's a very healthy addiction.
I mean, my seniors on Friday, wouldn't stop talking. They had a million interpretations, and that's the beauty of an inquiry method, an inquiry-based method, where I'm not lecturing. Mm-hmm. I might do just as much research as the person with the PhD. Maybe they know a little more than me, but hours of research beforehand. When was the artist born? What did the artist say? Who collected this work? What are the meanings? But I don't lead with that. I say, what do you notice? What strikes you?
Right.
And then they may say, oh, it's really dark, and I only see, but it looks like he's looking in the distance. And I say, oh, that's interesting. You know, Rembrandt, the artist who painted this, was celebrated because of his ability to show otherworldliness and other emotions shared amongst you. You know, that I'm giving a really deep quote about the work, but it's based on what the person has noticed. And that's how the whole conversation goes, layering and layering and feeding in information. And
yeah.
Anyway, next time you come to New York, you can come on one of our programs.
That would be fantastic. I have to get to a question that was arising for me, because as you were talking about how addictive it is and how, you know, and how inspired and mm-hmm. enthusiastic your students get, I was thinking about more the art worlds, you know, the art world proper, where by contrast, you know, and I don't want to be too harsh on the art world, but you know, there's a lot of jadedness. Let's just put it that way. I just wonder. Mm-hmm. So my question becomes, when you transition from your work, your job, to openings, gallery openings, or what have you, mm-hmm. just the mm-hmm. art world, however it is for you, what is that like? I mean, having that perspective of such excitement, enthusiasm, to more of a, I'm thinking of like the, there's this great line that this photographer describes when he's talking about a certain kind of music scene, you know, I think it was, he was talking about New York music scene in contrast to Seattle, mm-hmm. where like everybody sort of stands at the back of the room with their arms folded. That's just an image that came to mind. So anyway, take it where you will.
Yeah. I mean, for me, most of my, if I'm going to an opening or an exhibit, let's put it this way, an opening that I will tend to go to with other museum educator friends.
Mm.
And so, yes, it's totally more snobby, and maybe not snobby is not the right word, but it's a little more, people are a little more private with their enthusiasm for the artwork.
Well said, yes.
But because I'm looking with my friends, and we already love saying, what do you notice? What do you notice? What do you notice? Look at this light. Look. Mm. You know, we're having our own little private inquiries together. And so it's fun.
Right. Got it.
Most of the time, if I go to an exhibition at a museum, I go by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I just dork out and read everything. And
mm-hmm.
so it's interesting. I do crave inquiry-based experiences as a teacher, but how I like to get information as a learner or mm-hmm. as a consumer of art is kind of different. But that be said, if there were more programs available for people my age and my interests where it was inquiry-based, I would go. I just don't see those offered as much.
Right. Have you been on one of Lauren's gallery tours or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, tons of times.
Okay.
She does more inquiry. So her clients do want some information. They come expecting, you know, she can't do pure inquiry. I have a feeling because it's a private business and they're paying for it, they kind of have this expectation of her, because she's this PhD in art history, giving information.
Mm-hmm.
But she does a beautiful job of balancing that with discussion.
Mm.
I mean, I've been on probably 4 or 5 of her programs.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually teach together at the Guggenheim, younger people. So I've seen her in action a lot.
Right, right.
Her programs, again, she does give a lot of information, but she does try to make it inquiry-based. So there is some level of discussion, but it can't be like pure inquiry, because people will get upset. They have an expectation about learning
mm-hmm. right.
and how they want to learn.
Sure.
I have a feeling. Now, I don't know what Lauren has said about that, but that's been my experience as a participant on her. And obviously as a participant, I got to keep my mouth shut a little bit, because I can't, I got elected, you know, I don't, like, that's so interesting, because I read this book about what Jeff Koons said, you know, I can't do that.
Right, right, right. Let's, since you did mention how anecdote friendly, the teaching the Upper East Side private school kids. Let's go to them. Can you give me, tell me, you can't tell me the name of the school, but just tell me, describe the school and then talk about that experience.
Okay, so it's an all boys elementary to eighth grade school. And they have to wear suits and ties.
Mm.
And some of the schools in that neighborhood that I've worked with, you call the teacher by the first name, like Holly.
Mm.
Most of the time when students come visit me at the Guggenheim, they call me Miss Holly as a sign of respect.
Mm-hmm.
These students, the first class, I introduced myself as Miss Holly, and the headmistress spoke to me after the fact and said, "We're going to have to call you Miss Eckert."
Right, right.
So that set a certain tone for me.
Mm-hmm.
Although the teachers at the school are such lovely people, we're working together again next year, and I just love working with them. Everything I assume was wrong. So
what had you assumed?
But anyway. Well, like you were saying earlier about, you know, in asking me, do I prefer to work with people of privilege or people with less privilege, and what kind of impact do I want to make on the world? My first choice is not teaching art in an all-boys private school with suits and ties. Like, they come to art in suits and ties, and they have to roll up the sleeves and tuck the tie into the shirt. No, that's not my first choice. But I can remember, you know, Trump getting elected. The week he got elected was like mourning week for me and all my colleagues. No offense to anyone who's listening who supports Trump. Totally
don't
fine.
Worry. Don't think so. Yeah.
I mean, I just remember the morning of crying with my colleagues, like, how are we going to teach kids right now? This is like the worst. Like, what are we going to say?
Right.
And that, I think it was that week or that afternoon, we had the Agnes Martin show on view at the Guggenheim. And if you're not familiar with her work, a huge painting, made repeated marks, graphs, and lines, very slow and quiet and meditative works. And we took the boys to see this work, and this one boy gave me such a hard time all the time. I think he's a child of one of the diplomats or something, I'm not sure, but his parents are very wealthy. And, you know, this same boy had told me early on, "Miss Eckert, my dad told me anyone who doesn't go to private school gets a bad education." And I said, "Okay, well, child, whose name I'm not going to mention, I went to public school, so maybe you shouldn't take this art class because that means I have a bad education."
Ooh.
You know, I said, "I went to public school."
Right.
So maybe you should ask your dad about that, but think on that, you know?
Think on it.
And then the next day he wrote me an apology letter. It's actually on my fridge. Should I read it to you? It's so
please,
hilarious.
Like please,
The teacher made them write apology letters to us, and his was like the most personal one. He said, "Dear Miss Ecker, I like how you take us to the museum. I am sorry for rolling on the floor and calling out and saying something mean about public schools. And I'm really sorry. I like the spiral of the museum, and on Wednesday I will do a better job." So that's on my fridge.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, the same kid, we went to go look at the Agnes Martin. He's like, "This painting, this is so boring. Why do we have to look at this? Can't we just go downstairs and make art?" And I said, "Okay, give it 5 minutes." And we started talking, and I asked the boys to think of a word, the first word that comes to mind. And then they say the word, and I said, "Okay, now a pair of opposite ideas you see in the work. For example, black and white or light and dark." I gave a few, and then they do their opposites. And I say, "Okay, now a feeling that comes to mind." And they say, "Darkness and sadness and da-da-da-da-da and quietness and nothingness and boringness." And then I say to them, "Well, you know, I was reading about her, and one thing that this woman, this artist, Agnes Martin, said is for her, the act of creating this work was about expressing two emotions, and those emotions were joy and happiness. So I want you to look back again. Do you see anything new now that you know this information?" And all of them had like this aha revelation. "Oh my God, now I could see why. This is about America. This looks like the American flag. It's about war. It's about..." Suddenly they were saying, they're seven and eight,
right,
Michael. Okay.
Right,
so,
right.
And then we finished the conversation. They don't want to leave. This one boy comes up to me at the end. He said, "Miss Eckert, I'm really sorry. I gave you such a hard time, and now I understand why you wanted us to see that painting. I said, wow. Oh, really? Why did I want you to see that painting? And he said, well, because I think you wanted me to know that you shouldn't make up an idea about something before you give it a chance.
Aw.
And I said, okay, well, I almost said his name, but anyway, maybe you can keep that in your mind, because right now we have a new president. I know maybe I shouldn't have said this. I did say,
wow,
we have a new president, and some of the things he's saying is to not give people a chance. And maybe if you meet someone and you can remember this conversation we had about this painting, you'll give them a chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
that was my great story. But
no, that's good.
He's so sweet. And yeah, it was such an honest,
right,
pure child moment of like, I'm really sorry. I get it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It makes that whole class at the Agnes Martin makes me wonder whether your experience teaching kids of around that age is like with language, if they're in that sort of sweet learning zone where you can actually, given the right resources that you specifically clearly have, if you can get them to appreciate somebody like Agnes Martin, you know, just by sort of giving them the right tools, you know, that,
right,
that somebody who's maybe already just as young as even a teenager might be too late to sort of not be bored.
I don't think it's ever too late. I honestly, this method, it's so open.
Mm.
And the main thing you're doing is listening and giving people permission to use the artwork as a springboard for their ideas.
Right. Right.
I'm telling you, I'm looking with senior citizens who have never sat down and had this kind of conversation in front of an artwork, and they are addicted to it, just like me.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the young time, I think it is real. But it would be very different than me sitting down and saying, okay, boys, today we're going to be talking about prejudice. What does it mean to be prejudiced? You know?
Mm-hmm.
No, it didn't come out of that. It came out of a very pure, open-ended discussion, and then at the end, on his own, he made this revelation,
mm-hmm,
and then it was a teachable moment. But it's different than having an agenda like, today we're talking about blah, blah, blah. You know, we do thematic teaching, but it's not usually like prejudice or racism. We're not launching in with big ideas like that, but they do often come out through talking about the work.
Right.
Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, yeah, it totally makes sense. I wonder if, it's obviously one thing, and what you, the operative word in what you were just saying is conversation, you know, because that's that exchange that you have with your children and with your, mm-hmm, dementia and non-dementia seniors, you know, it, that's, mm-hmm, that's a, mm-hmm, very animated context, you know, for consuming art. I get it. So it's another thing altogether for somebody to go off on their own, you know, to see an Agnes Martin show. And so I guess my sort of follow-up question would be, just you have these conversations, you inspire these young minds, or not quite as young minds, you know, and if, mm-hmm, if some of them take to being self-motivated to go see more art on their own, great. If not, at least they'll have had that experience. Is it that kind of perspective?
Yeah. I mean, I hope, you hope as a teacher that you impact your students no matter what kind of teaching you do.
Mm-hmm.
My hope is that they will look at artwork in a slower way for the rest of their lives.
Mm, right.
Not 1, 2, 3. Okay. I saw it. Slow down. Talk about it with who's with you, or don't, but look, let your eyes take it all in. And I do a lot of drawing, you know, observational drawing as an entry point sometimes,
mm-hmm,
to looking at artworks with all of my audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because I say to them, it's not because I'm taking your drawing and I'm photographing it and putting it in order from best to worst on my refrigerator. No.
Right.
It's because in looking and drawing and observing, you slow yourself down to see all the details of the work of art, and then you see more. So really my goal is that they see more. And however that may, you know, maybe seeing more is being more experimental with materials when they're making, or just looking or talking.
Right.
Yeah. That is my hope for them.
Right. Well, first of all, I definitely need to visit one of your classes when I'm in New York for sure. I will definitely take you up on that.
Yeah.
But the adjacent thought to that is, I think artists as well as critics, writers, probably even collectors as well. I think our problem is not that we're not able to slowly take things in the way you described. I'm getting the words close, if not exactly right. But that we feel like we have too much to see. So, and it's, I would imagine it's especially the case in New York. So if I'm going to see, let's say, you know, 5 to 10 gallery shows in a day, especially if I'm doing it in a shorter window, I kind of, there might be something that really hits me that I'm, you know, that I'm going to spend a lot more time with. But there's definitely this sort of sense of urgency, like, oh, I can only spend, you know, especially with the show that you know you don't want to spend time with, you just get out of there. But with the shows that are maybe you could go break either way, you know what I mean? If you give it enough time, you're probably hedging towards just cutting it off. You know what I mean? So I guess I'm saying all that just to express it, but also to say, I bet you have some words of wisdom to that point.
I guess what I would say to keep in mind is that all these people that you're describing, me and you included, we already know how to look at art in a meaningful way. We know what we're looking for. We may not have the aha, it's about the meaning of life, can't you see that moment?
Right.
But there's a certain, I don't want to say baggage, it's not the right word, but there's a certain amount of knowledge we bring, prior knowledge that we bring to every artwork that we look at, which all people do, but I think we're a little more trained to be aware of what that is. Mm-hmm. And it's like scanning something and we can like, interested, not interested,
right.
Keep going, you know?
Right.
But maybe it means that when we do encounter something that is a little more, we're interested, we know how to maximize the time we want to spend. Like we can decipher that this is something worth spending time in front of.
Yeah. And then we have that whole additional problem of, well, I got to Instagram this, you know what I mean? And so we go into our, oh, well, how is this going to look on social media phase, you know? And then aren't we undermining then the meditative period?
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's just simple as that. I think I have like 4 pictures on my Instagram. I don't do that.
Oh, okay. You're a purist. Got it.
Yeah.
Good for you. Yeah.
I'm not. Well, I just don't really get how to use the technology. Maybe I'd be better. Maybe I'd do it more often.
Right. Well, Holly, I feel like we've covered a lot. I definitely want to give you the opportunity if you feel like you'd be remiss if we left anything out. But I feel like this has been really enlightening and inspiring.
It's been fun for me too. I hope everybody enjoys listening. And one more thing, I wanted to end with this very sweet story that
Please.
My aunt has been asking me to like submit to New York Times editorial since it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the Richard Armstrong, who's the director of the Guggenheim, I don't know if you've ever seen his photograph, but
he's a tall guy. I know, I've met him.
Yeah,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's very tall. He's very bald. He's very smiley and very nice. And one day I was in the elevator with kindergartners from the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Little babies, so cute. They were their first time to the museum. They came in. He came in the elevator by accident. We were going down up to the galleries, and he walked in, and it was like all these little kids and looking up at this big man in a bow tie and gray suit.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Boys and girls, that's the director of the Guggenheim." I said, and he got out, and I said, "If you see him again, his name is Armstrong." And I was like, "So look at your arm and make a song. That's how you can remember Armstrong." And he came back in after we finished the tour just by coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Hello." You know, he said, "Hello, boys and girls." And they said, "Hello, Mr. Armstrong." And then another man walked in just as tall, just as bald, maybe another art person. And he said, "Hello, boys and girls." And they went to get out of the elevator. And Richard Armstrong said, "Goodbye, boys and girls." And the one little boy just looked up and said, "Goodbye, twins." I don't
That's
know
sweet.
If it's relevant or not. It's just the sweetest story. They just look like twins to him. And then another time with him, he's so lovely and dear. He came into the elevator randomly, and third graders of this program we do, Learning Through Art, for children who go to Title I schools and don't get amazing art curriculum, art instruction, and he invited them up to his office while I was with them. We went up to the 8th floor. He took them around his private office, showed them the view from his window of the Guggenheim roof.
Wow.
Just an amazing, I mean, I really feel proud. I know I did a lot of talking, but like, for example, working at this institution, I'm just, he's so lovely and just the mission and everything. And just the way he's been to all the students he's ever met that I've had on tours just makes me really proud to do the work I do. And I just thought I would end with that little anecdote.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Well, Holly, this has been great. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay. And we're out. Fantastic. Thank you so much again to Holly Ecker. Lovely talking to her. And indeed, Holly, I will be taking you up on that offer to come along on one of your tours or classes in New York next time I'm there. Of course, has been a while since I've been in New York, so I don't know when that will be, but hopefully the offer stands and we will make it happen next time I'm there. So thank you in advance. And if you guys are in New York, you know, I'd be happy to put you guys in touch. Maybe you can go on a tour as well if that's something you'd like to do. Or I should say class, not tour. Again, the website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. You can go check out the images that she talked about, representative of her education life there. And by the way, Richard Armstrong is somebody that I knew as a child because he was out in Southern California working in San Diego at a museum there. And so I knew him a little bit. I met him again briefly at the Guggenheim. At the Whitney, where he was a curator many years ago. So hello to Richard, if you're listening to this, which I'm sure you are not. Hello. What else? Wanted to, as I said earlier in the intro, I did have a conversation with a local artist and who is very involved in, has gotten very involved in activism, becoming active in regards to the regime that was sworn in, so to speak. So we're going to be getting into that and getting into politics quite a bit, so you can look forward to that, I hope. It looks like it's going to be a two-parter. What's coming up? I do have a show that I have organizing, as you may have heard. It's coming up this spring at Charlie James Gallery in Los Angeles, and I'm going to give you more details as we get a little closer, but just wanted to give you a reminder about that. And yeah, do please support the show if you can. If not financially, which you can do through Patreon or PayPal, you can also follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And would really appreciate it if you haven't already, if you leave a very nice review. It can be extremely short. Most important thing is that you give it 5 stars and just say, love this podcast or something like that. Listen to this podcast every week, whatever. It's going to help more people find the show. That's the way it works on the iTunes power metric. So thank you in advance for doing that. If you could, always happy to hear from you. If you have any feedback that you would like to share, always open to it. So thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to Holly. I enjoyed talking to you guys. And I will talk to you next week, it looks like, for now. But keep those donations coming if you can. Thank you very much in advance. Ciao for now.